Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well,
wow.
I was really trying to do it at the same time as you.
I saw you do this big wind up.
Dang it, I shouldn't have telegraphed it.
You're trying to usurp my role.
No, I'm just trying to get on par is
okay.
All. I'm
okay.
Just trying to be, you know, you get to do it all the time and every now and then it's like, you know.
Casey, would you like to do the intro?
No.
Please.
All right. Welcome to Completely Arbitrary. I'm Casey Clapp.
And I'm Alex Croson.
Panic. What else do I say?
Your eyes did get frighteningly wide.
Because I immediately forgot every other word that you always say.
Yeah, it's usually like, what's up, fungal associates?
Hey, everyone. I'm Alex Cool Croson.
Alex Cool Guy Croson.
Yeah, all right.
Casey Cool Sorry. Guy Clapp.
You do it.
No, we're going to keep all of that.
Oh, all right. Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, the podcast about trees and other such items as things and et ceteras, like dirt. That's not dirt. It's called soil. I suck at this.
Swish.
Anyway, thanks, Alex.
Casey Clapp, how you doing, pal?
Oh, I'm just doing great. Played a bunch of Sand Beach Ultimate this weekend.
Sand Beach Ultimate. That really, sounds yeah. exhausting.
It is quite exhausting. Every time you try to run, the ground beneath your feet gives out because it's just sand.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
A great workout.
Yeah, I feel like I got a good workout. And on top of that, you can lay out all the time because it's just sand. It still hurts a little bit, but not near as bad as grass and, you know, hard fields.
By laying out, you mean fall.
Oh, no, yes, fall with a composed goal in mind.
Oh, like reaching for the frisbee.
Yes.
And you dive for it.
Exactly, yeah, okay. That's exactly
falling
it.
Out, reaching out?
Laying out. Yes,
okay.
Laying out. In the frisbee parlance, they call it bid.
Bid?
Yeah, like you bid for it.
Wow.
Get it? Like you know, you bid, like you put an effort, you know, like
Do you yell, I got it?
No, you usually don't yell. I mean, some people do, but other times if you're just running, you just go for it.
I see.
Yeah, there's no, it's an unspoken thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great. Had a bunch of beers on the beach, got a little sunburn.
Uh-oh.
I know, it's bad. I should have learned my lesson by now. We were a fish-themed team, and I was wearing fishnets.
Oh, that kind of fish.
Yeah, check it out.
Okay, Casey is standing up to show me his tan lines. My boy, you've been grilled.
What do you think?
It's like cross marks,
yeah.
Hatch marks on a grilled burger.
Yeah, I'll take a picture of it. It's not worth it, but yeah, I got a pretty good tan on the back of my legs that is just like in a fishnet pattern, like the sexy fishnets you'd wear if you were, you know, wearing fishnets to be sexy.
Well, that's great, Casey. You've got like you literally have sexiness burned into your skin.
Yeah, well, exactly. Thank you, Alex.
A lot of people pay a lot of good money for that.
They sure do. Instead, I just go to the beach and I stand in the sun for too long.
Yeah, we got to get some sunblock on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I do. It's a next thing. Well, what about you? How are you, sir?
I'm okay. I get a little burnt out of every time I'm asked, how are you, Alex? I'm like, I'm whatever. You know, I've had a stretch of a little bit of a bad time.
Can I tell you, though, I always encourage that you say, not you, one says,
yes.
They're doing great, no matter what.
Oh, you want people to do that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because then I don't, okay, I don't want them to. I want them to do it for themselves because it's a state of mind thing. You know, if you answer the question, I'm doing bad.
All right.
You're going to feel bad. But if you answer the question, you know what? I'm doing great. Then you'll trick yourself into being just a little happier.
Okay. Ask me again how I'm doing.
Hey, Alex, how's it going, man?
I'm doing great.
You can't do it.
No?
Great work.
Does that count?
I think that counts.
Casey, we have so gosh darn much to get to today.
We do. A whole nation.
We do. We are talking...
Two nations.
America today.
Yeah, we are.
We are talking a specific American tree.
Yep.
I don't mean to nationalize this tree. It's just what it's called.
True. It also grows in other countries.
Oh, so we can't lay claim to it.
No. It's also in Canada.
Well, today we are talking about the... American elm.
That is it. Everyone, praise be. What a beautiful tree.
Ulmus americana?
Yeah, you didn't even look at your notes. You stared me right in the eye.
That's
you said
right.
You've been practicing.
I remembered Ulmus because it sounds unique.
Yeah, it is. And also, actually, I think it sounds like elm, like so much.
Oh, yeah. Elm.
Elm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they just add a little us to it and they make it sound like it's fancy.
And this is the very first elm that we've covered on the show.
Oh, my gosh. This is. Yeah. Yes. Oh, nice.
We've done multiple firs, multiple spruces, I think. Just the one spruce.
We just did the one fir.
So, Casey, today we're talking Ulmus americana, the American elm. Let's imagine, like every episode, that you and I are walking through a beautiful... Hey, how about this, Casey?
Yes.
Let's localize it.
All right.
We're walking through the Laurelhurst neighborhood.
Yes, we are.
About half a mile south east of our current location. These big $14 million homes in Portland.
Yeah, it's true. They're pretty fancy.
These gorgeous, if I may
simply
say so.
Stunning.
American elms covering the entire street. You and I taking a little stroll up there. We're having a difficult conversation. You're telling me all that lack of sunblock is catching up to me, Alex.
All my shirts hurt.
You show me the dark mole on your back.
Yeah, luckily there's no moles there yet.
Yeah.
But I will tell you about this tree nonetheless.
Yes.
Moleless as it is. So go ahead.
I was literally, I am such a stickler for repetition that
sorry.
I was literally about to say, Casey, tell us about this tree.
Sorry. I'm just, I throw you off every time.
No, you don't. You're fine.
Well, the funny thing is, I was actually riding my bicycle through that area just, I think, like last week.
Wow.
And I remember saying, I'm going to take Alex here when we do the American elm.
Did we do that?
No, but you've already been there, so it's already happened.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with that street.
So the American elm, Ulmus americana, is an elm species that is native to basically eastern North America. I think it grows almost all the way down through, like maybe into Georgia, that area into the southeast a little bit. But certainly an eastern species, and it grows down in bottomland areas, so it takes the really sort of less than stellar soil, likes to have its feet wet a little bit, but the soil in like those bottomland areas, it just tends to be lacking in nutrients. They get leached out a lot through the rain and through different getting inundated with water and things.
Oh, the water washes away the nutrients in the soil?
It kind of leaches them away, exactly.
Whoa,
yeah.
Okay.
So otherwise, their water would stay in the soil. It would never drain away, so you end up getting anaerobic conditions, so there's just no oxygen down there.
I see, but the elms like that?
They tolerate it. I wouldn't say like it.
Okay.
I'm sure they would be like, no, honestly, give me a sweet, like, well-drained loam field. I'm going to love it, but I guess if I'm stuck here, that's fine.
I see. They are where they are, and they're like, well, I can't get up and walk away.
Yeah, exactly. But they do tend to grow there more than most other species. And that's the same for a lot of different elm species across the world. They tend to take these kind of really streamside riparian habitats.
Okay. Oh, riparian.
Yes, there you go. Yeah.
Along the side of a swamp?
Exactly.
Wetland.
Well, yeah, wetland. Well, I guess, it's the transition zone between an upland and a lowland.
Yes.
But I think it could be next to a stream, a creek, a river.
See.
I think technically a lake as well. But sometimes, like, they change things. Like, if there's a deposit by a lake, that's a certain term. There's a deposit by a river. It's a certain term.
Okay.
A swamp, you know, all these things.
Our friend the black willow also likes these conditions.
Yes, it does.
Maybe not likes, but lives there.
I think lives there, yeah. And also the black walnut does very well in these situations well. Which is funny. All those trees, well, I guess not the willow, they kind of do well in the streets, which is a thing that has to do with this tree as well.
Okay.
Because when you plant these things in the urban environment, they are generally living in similar conditions because they're growing underneath pavement. The soil has been compacted. There's not a whole lot of oxygen. Water doesn't really percolate down as normal as it would otherwise. So they kind of get these really rough conditions and they just kind of do well, you know?
Interesting. Well, let's talk leaf.
Let's get into this. Let's see. So these leaves are adorable. Oh my gosh. This is the fun thing about these leaves. Okay. So they are alternately arranged. They're simple leaves and they have little... I think they have little serrations over
sure
the end.
Do.
I guess technically, I'm thinking they're doubly toothed or doubly serrated.
Yes, they are.
Now, so here's the thing, is that they have a base that's called oblique, which I think is super fun.
Wow, I think I see what you're about to say. Please continue.
Well, so if you're looking at the leaf, if you're holding the very bottom of the petiole where it would connect to the stem, and you start looking upwards, the left side of the leaf blade is going to be more lower on the petiole than the right side, or vice versa. I don't think it has to be right or left in this case.
Yeah.
Just one side is offset.
Where they come out of the petiole, they're a little skewed.
Yeah, exactly.
They do a little curveball, and then they straighten out.
And then they all get back to normal as they go up to a nice little acuminate, little pointed tip there at the top.
Do we know why?
No idea.
Okay.
No idea why. It might be that, like, as they are growing and, like, angled a certain way, because the twigs are famously zigzaggy, the buds are just like blah 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 blah, and they're just perfectly zigzag. You know, have you ever, as a kid, did you ever get one of those little toys that was like they were like little connectors that just connected to each other? You could twist them and they would snap back into place at a 90 degree angle.
Yes,
but they would only be like maybe a foot long, and you could just go click 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 and like click them in little zigzag things.
Yeah, sure.
Now if you did that and just went left right left right left right left right and you looked at it, that is what a twig of an American elm and many elms look like.
Wow.
Because their buds just come out at these perfect little, like, they're not really intense zigzag where it's like whoa whoa whoa. You can just see like whoop 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 whoop,
okay,
whoop, going left right left right left right. So it might be that they're growing further, like they put their growth first on the outside but not on the inside or something.
This is fascinating.
Yeah, I'm just guessing, by the way. This is
well, I mean, conjecture. The fact that these leaves are like that is fascinating.
Yeah, it's a super good ID characteristic because there's another closely related species, the Zelkova, that does not do that. And if you feel the leaves, most of the time the leaves of the elm are going to be the American elm. They're going to be kind of rough, like they're going to be sandpapery.
Okay.
Zelkova also. But the Zelkova, the base is not oblique. It's not unequal or offset. It's perfect. I don't say perfect. There's always going to be a tiny bit of variation, but they will most likely be perfectly level, whereas most elms always have those offset leaves.
Well, I want to end this ID discussion with morphology of the tree as a whole.
Good.
So let's talk bark.
Yeah, the bark is one of the most beautiful barks, especially as it gets older. It gets, I don't know, I always think about it, I feel like I saw a commercial for like Kraft macaroni or Kraft cheese, like those little fake American cheese slices.
Oh, the singles?
You know? Yeah, and they were like pulling it sideways.
Yeah.
And it like ripped in kind of like a weird stringy way, but like with vertical strings.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I imagine they look like as a tree grows out. So they have really long, deep furrowed ridges that kind of pop out, and they get really intense, and they go all the way up the tree as they get older and bigger. And so they're just these like big, dark, gray lines. The textures are so satisfying to look at.
Yeah, they really are.
And they get these big fat burls on them, and they tend to have what is, I guess they're just normal gray. Like, there's not a whole lot to them beyond that. Like, tree gray, let's just say that.
Okay, yeah.
Dark gray.
Yeah, they're just sort of gray, grayish, brownish.
Yeah, exactly. And so they grow up, and they have, this obviously gets much more intense as it gets bigger. So bigger, they get deeper and deeper, and again, it looks like you have a bunch of long vertical lines that are lines or X's that kind of always cross over and reconnect and then rip apart, but are really, you know, very, I'm imagining touching one right now, Alex, because they're so nice to touch. I highly encourage everyone does it.
Yeah, I can't help but stop and just run my hands along the bark.
Hey, yeah.
And I go, ow, shit.
You realize that you just like stuck your finger into a hole.
Yeah, then I look at my hand and I have a 4-inch splinter in my palm.
Yeah, that's you got a hard life, man.
How do I stop that from happening?
You just wear gloves. No, because then you can't feel it. No, run your hands down gently. Yeah, now not we're up. There you go.
Or side to side.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Play it like a playing the
a harp.
Harp. What I'm thinking the
wind chimes.
The wind chimes. Yeah. Thank you.
Or chimes, I guess. Yeah. Called.
Yeah, finger chimes probably in this case.
Yeah, those are called chimes, and then the ones you hang in your backyard at your aunt's house.
Those are the winds.
Those are wind chimes.
Gotcha. Same page.
Yep.
Well, the last bit to note is that they have these little seeds. Before we get into the best part about what makes these trees so special, is they have these adorable little seeds. And the seeds, I think they're actually winged samaras, but I should just make sure.
Wow.
Of that, shouldn't I? The little round disc-like samara is what I'm reading. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it just has this seed, and then it has this little papery halo that grows around it.
Yes.
And you can see these in early spring just fluttering everywhere. I remember this from the first time I learned what these things were. As you walk through spring in any city that has elms, you'll just see these little things all over the place.
Now, they look a bit to me like a 2D eyeball.
Yeah, that's a great description.
Because they've got a little iris and pupil, and then they have the whites, which is the papery bit.
Yeah, that's totally it. Yeah.
Is that considered the samara itself, or is the whole thing the samara?
I think the whole thing is the samara, and the seed on the inside is, I think technically to be a samara, the seed has to be more or less connected, like everything's fused together. So the seed and the outer like coating of the seed, and then the ovary, which is the fruit of this whole bit that becomes the samara, I think it's all one thing. That's all fused together.
I see.
So those things, they come out in droves. They just flutter around, obviously, because they are so wind driven. They're also water driven. This is why they're so good in their habitat. Oh. They just go fly down, hit the water, sail over to the side, and then germinate in this lovely little sandy beach that they've fallen upon.
They're perfect floaters.
They really are. Yeah, they just sit there flat, right? Like little rafts.
Yeah, yeah, little seed rafts.
I want to imagine an ant on it, just going for its its big adventure
with a matchstick as an oar.
This is a Disney movie waiting to happen.
Hey, listen up, Kathleen Kennedy.
Please.
I think that's who that is.
I have no idea. I was thinking Ed Asner.
Oh, well, they have two different jobs.
Yeah. We'll give them a call.
Each of them a call.
Yeah. Who's at Pixar? That's really what this is. This could be the A Bug's Life reboot.
See, now we're talking.
A Bug's Life 2.
Hey, where the hell is Bug's Life 2?
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. I know we're on a tight schedule today. I shouldn't have brought it up.
I brought it up. I think it's a good thing to bring up.
Where the hell is Bug's Life 2?
I don't know. I think it should be there because that was one of my top favorites. I thought it was great.
Me too. We got a Cars 7 and we got no Bug's Life 2.
Is it really a Cars? Let's round up to 7. That's disgusting.
I think they have 3 of those.
Yeah, they're going to be just doing like, they're going to get back to Cars.
Yeah.
Because like the Fast and the Furious, like they had to make up new names because they're like Fast and the Furious 18. They're like, now it's just Furious or just Fast or Car.
There's one that's like FF.
FF, that's it? There's just F and F.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah, good for them.
Yeah, they're making money.
I guess so.
Anyway, Alex, the morphology, I know you're waiting for
it. Yeah, man, I'm itching. Let's talk it.
This is the quintessential vase-shaped tree.
Vase shaped.
Yes, it's an ID characteristic of this tree so thoroughly like innate to the species that you can see this tree from afar and be like, I don't even need to get closer. I know exactly what that tree is.
I see.
I will bet $30 on it and one sandwich.
It's a real street hugger.
It is. And this is why people planted it on the street. So first off, as we already said, it does so well, right? Like it can take the conditions and it just keeps cooking.
Right.
But it also, let's say you got to drive a bunch of buses underneath there. You got power lines or something. It grows up and then just cascades shades over and then sets its branches down. So it'll connect over the middle of the road, shade that, grow up and over the sidewalk and everything else. So you have all this room. So when you're walking through all these old neighborhoods in Portland, the park blocks all have American or some other kind of hybrid elm planted. Those are all so gorgeously majestic because of these big, gigantic stems that come up and then just cascade with this mop top of hair that comes out. And so it's that as soon as you learn this tree and someone says, look at the vase shape of the silhouette and the form of the whole tree, the first time you see it, you won't forget it. You're like, oh, that's more obvious than any tree I've ever seen.
For sure. Is that a common term in the tree world, a vase shape?
Yeah, you would say so because it's not quite rounded. It's not quite upright because it's upright for a second, but then it has that like immediate like...
Yeah.
So I think it is, but it's mostly common with this species. So okay. A couple other species, they'll say, oh, it's kind of a vase shaped. But if you're going to say, give me an example of a vase shaped tree, this is the example.
Almost Americana.
Yeah, it's like, give me an example of a Christmas tree. The first thing you're like, well, it's a Douglas fir. Let's just use that as the quintessential, like, archetype.
The triangle tree?
Yeah, exactly. It's the triangle tree. This is the vase tree.
I also want to make a pitch here.
You should.
For the fountain tree.
Oh.
It looks a bit like just water coming out of a fountain.
Yeah,
like
all right.
This on both sides.
Okay, yeah, I could see that. That
like
makes
an ornamental
sense.
Like Greek fish fountain that you might find in the Acropolis.
So then would the trunk have to look like a fish or like a little boy's penis or something? I'm just imagining Greek fountains, and they're usually like some kids like spitting or
yes.
I feel like I've seen one that's come out of a penis
for sure. I think that's probably Cupid.
Oh yeah, probably
a rendering of Cupid.
What a character.
Although the cherub Cupid, I think, came later. I think he was just like a normal looking like man.
Yeah, he was probably gorgeous.
Yeah.
Shaven though.
Cupid is cool. Who's your favorite Greek god while we're talking about it?
My favorite Greek god right off the bat? Honestly, I have to go with like, it's the old standard. It's Dionysus.
Okay, cool.
Standard, I did theater and he was a big part of that whole crew that we were with. And also, like, he's got parties, he's got a theater, he's got fun, he's got a wine. Like, I really want, I want to get a tattoo of him.
Yes.
I think I've told you.
You have, but please tell us again.
It's another baby bean. My mom's going to be so upset. It's this little fat cherub baby leaning on a bottle or like a big, it's like a old centuries painting looking thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's this baby who's leaning against a wine barrel, drinking a jug of wine and peeing at the same time.
Oh my God.
That's apparently a anthropomorphized Dionysus. Like some guy was like, this is how I imagine Dionysus.
Wow.
And I really want to get that. I just think that's, of all the ways to imagine a god, I think that's just one of the best ways.
If that ain't living life, I don't know what is.
I don't know what is. That's my, what's yours?
I'm a Hermes. I'm reading Mythos by Stephen Fry, and so far Hermes I was just so charmed by.
Hermes is, he does seem like he's got it going on.
He's the deliverer, not among many, many, many other things, the messenger. Yeah. And Casey, how about a message from our sponsors?
What?
We'll be right back after this break. More Completely Arbitrary coming at you. Casey.
Hi, Alex.
You know something about me?
I do.
And you do know this, that I love to be cozy.
Yes, that is very true. Unfortunately, I have to get you out of your bed to do work. You know, because our studio here is small.
Yeah, Casey physically drags me out of bed every morning. And you know what?
Slap a pair of headphones on.
And you know what I'm sleeping on, Casey?
What are you sleeping on today, Alex?
My brand new Cozy Earth bedding.
Oh, Alex, I heard about this.
And you know what I'm sleeping in?
What?
My brand new Cozy Earth jogger set.
Ooh, hold on. Let me get a feel of that. Not your sheet. I'm getting my own sheet.
That's right.
Ooh, this is smooth.
Casey is wrapped in his new Cozy Earth bedding. Now, Casey just returned from Italy.
Just got back.
Land of soft fabrics.
Exactly.
And he has waiting for him products from our brand new sponsor, Cozy Earth. Casey, what do you think?
This is incredible. I don't think I've ever felt something so soft and so like, I don't know. It feels silky and smooth, and it looks beautiful.
It's true, Casey. And you know what? I have been sleeping in my Cozy Earth clothing.
Well, Alex, have you noticed anything about your sleep?
I have been sleeping so well. And here are some things I love about sleeping in my Cozy Earth bedding and my Cozy Earth clothes.
Yeah.
This is no longer officially an ad. This is just me talking.
Hey, let everyone just come on in. Just come on in here.
Casey, it is temperature regulating, so I no longer have any problems with getting too warm, getting too cool, having to get up and shut the window, having to get up and open the window, turn the heat on, turn the heat off. I sleep through the night. Soon I'll be eating solid foods. And I have such a good time doing it. Casey, I know you've been traveling, you've been flying, you've been not sleeping in your own bed. I cannot tell you how excited I am for you to try this brand new Cozy Earth bedding.
I cannot tell you how much I agree. Just feeling it, I'm essentially swaddled in a sheet right now, Alex.
That's right,
and
you are.
I cannot tell you how excited. I'm going to wash this. I'm going to throw it on my bed today.
Hell yeah.
So if you want to be as cozy as Alex and I, then go to CozyEarth.com and after your purchase, enter the promo code TREES, T-R-E-E-S, to get 35% off. That's huge.
And Casey, how about this? All of Cozy Earth's products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. I don't have that kind of warranty on my tires.
I don't have that kind of warranty on anything.
So go to CozyEarth.com and use promo code TREES for 35% off. Now go and get cozy.
Yeah, you go get cozy now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hi, everybody. It's Alex here. And you know what? Come springtime, those trees are a-blooming. Those people are a-walking around. That sun is a-shining. And it makes me so grateful for my social life. People are wanting to do things again. And it can be extremely rewarding to start to see friends more often and, you know, go on cute friend dates or romantical dates. Sit on a patio and drink a coffee. Ooh la la. But it's really easy to overdo it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on my social battery. Every time I go on a social outing, I come home and I'm like, wow, I am really tired in a very specific way. Well, that's my battery. That's my social battery being drained. And I didn't really have this language until I started going to therapy. I didn't know why being around people made me so exhausted. Even though I love those people and enjoy being around them, but therapy helped me with my self-awareness and helped me unlock some language that I didn't otherwise have. And if you are struggling with feelings and thoughts that you don't understand, therapy can be a great way to unlock the power of understanding. And a great way to start is BetterHelp. It's completely online and it's designed to be super convenient and flexible, which is very important. How many times have you had a therapy session on the calendar and that time rolls around and you think, I got to drive all the way across town. I am not going to go. It has, of course, happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to everybody who's been in therapy. No worries with BetterHelp. It's all online. And all you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist, of course. And nobody nails it on their first time. It's like going on dates. You gotta find the right therapist for you. It's silly to think that the very first date you ever go on is going to be your future spouse. So you can switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. It's extremely easy. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/trees today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trees. Happy spring! Welcome back to more completely arbitrary Ulmus Americana. We're talking today the American Elm.
The American Elm.
And I am familiar with the subject that we're going to be talking about today.
Yes.
In the second half of our episode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But obviously, you are the man with the subject.
Well, we're going to talk about it.
So please, Casey, Take it away.
Well, as you recall, we talked earlier, I think it was a couple weeks ago, about the calorie pair.
Yeah.
And I brought up that the calorie pair is a more or less a replacement street, not a replacement street tree, but it was a street tree that they brought it back and they're like, oh, this is going to be the perfect street tree.
Right.
It's a little beautiful thing.
And it was. Yeah. It was the perfect street tree.
For the first 30 seconds of its life. And then it became the worst street tree. No matter what your cones say.
Agree to disagree.
I guess we're going to have to do that. Anyway, this little tree was replacing a long-lost tree that used to be the quintessential American tree. So I highly recommend, again, everyone go pick up Jill Jones or Jonas's book, Urban Forests.
Oh, yeah.
You want to, if you're interested, go check it out at our website. We have a link to it. So check that out, because Jill goes through a spectacular history of this tree, the sad rise and fall of the American elm.
Wow.
So way back when, I'm going to do a really quick history. We started planting trees along gigantic boulevards, like in Marseille, France, and like France and like these big rich estates. They wanted these nice allées of trees, which is just a line of very similar, if not the same tree, basically opposite each other on either side of a road, right?
Allée?
Allée, yeah.
Okay.
Which is like all one word. I think it's L-L-A-L-L-E with a little thing over it, a little accent. So it's a very common like landscape and normal architectural kind of idea.
Yeah.
So very European, especially.
Okay.
So Europeans came over here, colonized and took over North America, and they brought over a lot of their same ideals. And so way back when, we would just basically plant these things to look nice. Like, it was just like, oh, this will make it look like we're walking through a park, which at the time, it essentially was, you know? Like, you would just plant it on either side of a park, and you'd have people living on the either side. They would put them in the open spaces and, you know, that kind of thing in the middle of cities before we had any real regulations. You know, it was just open space. It was like the commons, right?
Interesting.
But then we started developing cities in a more specific way. So we started planting trees more specifically, and we started to design our cities with curbs. And we wanted the curbs because things were getting so muddy and so mucky before we had like, what was it called? A macadam street is the term. We also had, macadam street is basically a street that was paved. Okay. And they called it a macadam street or a macadam.
Why?
I really don't know why. I read that in a fun book called The Bike Snob.
Huh?
Yeah, it's a silly book out of this guy from New York.
You know the original working title of that book was The Casey?
I hope it was. And then they're like, nah, we got to make this more New York-centric. He's too West Coast. they also had like cobblestone streets. So you'd have these big cobblestones, but then everything was really muddy if it wasn't one of those two things.
Sure.
So they started like building these curbs, and then you would have people like come by and flush it, and the curbs basically kept stuff in the road and then gave people on the sidewalks a place to go.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so it is sidewalks, and this isn't like there's not a direct line. Like, there's lots of places they design things differently, so
sure.
I don't want to say it's like, yes, this and then this and then this, and that's the perfect thing. You just started to see it develop.
It's a rough history.
Yeah, it's a rough history. And so they started making in fancy big neighborhoods these planting strips in between the sidewalk areas where they would expect you to be walking, and then the curb area, and then everything in between that. That's where you would keep the cars and the horses and the carriages and the poop and all that stuff. So in these little tree lawns is what they called, over especially in the eastern United States, where we had really rich neighborhoods, and they wanted things to look their own fancy way.
Sure.
They would design their streets like this, and they would plant these big, gorgeous, beautiful trees, and they would plant elm trees.
Is that partly, I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead.
The design of that, is that partly to sort of like divide, like a natural barrier between the people walking on the sidewalk and the muck of the street?
You know, I don't think initially that was the idea. Okay. I think it was more, this is pretty. We want this to look nice.
I see.
And every rich estate kind of place had these lines of trees going by it. So it's just more of an aesthetic callback, I think, more than anything. But I don't know. Jill might have actually a little bit more information on this. Jill Jones.
Maybe a, in her book. Maybe a, just a fortunate side effect.
Exactly. You know? And that's kind of what it became later down the line.
Yeah.
But they found that if they planted this one tree, the American elm, it had this perfect shape. It did so great in these lawns, and it had this regalness to it that everyone just loved. So as soon as they figured out that would, this is a great tree, and they started designing, you know, your general road in this way, they would start planting these trees all over the place. And I mean, everywhere.
And we're talking Eastern United States?
Yeah, Eastern United States, okay. Eastern Canada, Central United States. Everywhere the tree would grow, they would plant it.
I see.
And they all, at the same time, we were importing other trees from other places, like, say, Europe. So we planted these incredible trees. I can't remember the stat, but it was some like obscenely ridiculous percentage of any tree that was planted anywhere in the United States as a street tree was an elm.
Okay.
Like 90%, like some crazy wow. amount, right? It's because it was the perfect tree and everyone's like, this is a perfect tree. Let's just plant this perfect tree. And I was like, yeah, why would we not plant a perfect tree?
Right.
Well, turns out that perfect tree had an Achilles heel.
Oh, boy.
And as we were importing all these other plants from Europa, we ended up bringing that Achilles heel straight into the heartland.
Oh, my gosh.
It's the saddest thing. But essentially, in the early 1900s, actually, I think it was like 1945 or something like that, we started bringing over these this elm species, some European species of elms, and they had this disease on it. We're like, what is this disease? I don't know, but it's killing all of our elms.
Oh my God.
And then all at once, this ravaged all of our cities where we just had elm tree after elm tree after elm tree after elm tree die.
Wow.
And these trees were big because remember all the fancy places, they started planting these trees way back when, and they had these gorgeous regal neighborhoods like Laurelhurst, like Ladd's Addition, like Irvington, all these big fancy neighborhoods that started to develop when it was so chic and you would go buy a house in the suburbs on block 15 away from the muck of the inner east side.
So if we're talking, just to get a time frame in everybody's brains, for the East Coast planting of the American elm, are we talking like 1700s?
You know, I think so. Well, they still had these big elm trees because they would grow and just keep living in like the worst places. So like you would just be walking through the street, you'd have this little common park tree that would be in the middle of, like think Gangs of New York, the Five Points, you know that movie?
Yeah.
So that's where all these like five streets came, this where everyone congregated, like everyone was just defecating everywhere because this is like the 17, 1800s.
Yikes.
Nothing's nice. There's pigs and cows and goats and everything in the middle of the city. That this tree would just survive. So if you just don't pay attention to it and you just don't care about it, 50 years later, you got a big, massive tree and everyone would be like, oh, it's this big, massive tree. It's doing great. So it would be the centers of like these common areas.
I see.
Then it would be planted as we started to develop instead of having I guess it was kind of developed when we started moving a little bit further out of the city and started to kind of develop a little bit out.
I gotcha.
And make more, I don't know, I don't want to say suburbs because that really didn't happen until the middle of the 1900s.
Yeah.
But this is in like, you go to New York and back then you would go to like, I can't even imagine, like Central Park in Manhattan.
Yeah.
That used to be on the outskirts of town.
Right. So it's just any place that's like on the outer edges of this, of the, like the commercial, commercial downtown.
Exactly. And then, so like in Portland here, Laurelhurst is just 30 blocks in, but that used to be, as soon as you got to say Cesar Chavez, everything past that was just farmland.
Wow.
And so this was in the early 1900s, the late 1800s, the 20s. So easily 50 or 70 years before that over in New York, Boston, all these other places.
I see.
And that's on top of the trees that were already growing there that they just kind of left and just kind of built around. Because
I see.
Also, way back then, a lot of times it was just easier to just leave the tree because you would have to get like 30 men and a bunch of horses and you'd all have to axe it down. And, you know, it was just a whole big thing.
Right.
So it's like, can we just leave this tree and move around it? And like, okay, cool.
Build your shit around the tree.
Yeah, exactly. Because elms were also not the best tree to use for lumber and things like that. They would much prefer to use the pines and things like that.
Okay.
So we ended up making these the most commonly planted tree in all of the cities as we started to develop, you know, cities and kind of the way we see them now. And because of that, we had them everywhere. We had no other trees. We would not really plant a whole lot of maples, maybe in some specific locations. We didn't really care about oaks, maybe in some specific places. Maybe someone just preferred an oak here rather than this. But the elm tree was a quintessential thing. So all these new trees came in from Europe, and they brought this disease over. And this disease started killing our trees, and we're like, why is this happening? What is happening? What exactly is going on here? And it took them several years to figure it out, but they had to have, like, botanists and people like, oh, okay, what's happening? And, like, they literally did, like, a USDA search because they were like, this was an intense problem. Every tree was dying mysteriously. And they ended up learning that there is this disease, and the scientific name of this one is Ophiostoma ulmi and Ophiostoma novo ulmi, which means like new ulmi.
So those, it's kind of like two different diseases,
but they do the same thing. They're very closely related. We call them today Dutch elm disease. And that's because they came from a Dutch elm, allegedly.
Okay.
Which is really just kind of like the same kind of species that grows in Europe. We call them English elms, Siberian elms, these kinds of things.
I see.
So it is a native species, native disease over to Europe and not, or a little bit also over to Asia, because it's one big landmass. So if you have different elm trees that have been exposed to this over the last several hundred millions of years, they're going to have been like, nah, we're still alive. We're going to develop with it. Now, if you were, let's say, across an ocean from this disease, those trees may have been already separated and started to speciate before this disease came, or that disease might have just spread from a different place. You know, there's 100 different things that you could think of, but for whatever reason, the American elms, and that is all of the elms that grow in North America, were never exposed to this.
Yikes.
And if they were exposed, they did not develop enough immunity to it. In fact, really any immunity whatsoever.
Right.
So, as soon as you bring this disease over, the same thing that's happened to not only plants, but also the people in this whole landmass,
yeah,
a disease came through that they had no protection against, no exposure to previously, and it just went absolutely ham, destroyed almost every single elm tree in all these big, beautiful cities before we even could figure out what it was.
Wow.
Or how it spread.
Do you know what, I mean, I'm really into timelines today, I guess. And yeah, like temporally, like how long from when it was first introduced to when they were like, oh, wow, we have a problem.
Oh,
like,
man.
How long would that take? Like how slowly does a tree die to a disease?
So you know? This is actually, that's a very interesting question. Let me give you a little background on the disease.
Okay.
So it's a fungal disease and it grows. So this is a fungal association that isn't quite, it is a little one-sided, I guess you could say. Yeah. So this fungus, Dutch elm disease, it rides on the backs of little beetles.
Okay.
They are called the vectors for it. So the vector, this little beetle, is a bark beetle. So it goes under and it just eats a little bit underneath the bark, and then it has its brood, and then its brood flies away, does it to another elm.
Okay.
Normally, this beetle, there are native beetles to the United States. There's also ones that have come over from from Europe. They do not kill the elm trees. The elm trees are like, yeah, whatever, we're just going to live with this. We're going to move on. We're going to be fine. However, as those little beetles burrow through the bark, they make a wound in that tree. And if they have on their backs from a previous dead tree a bunch of little spores, they're literally walking the spores underneath all the protections of the tree into the tree's vascular system.
Oh my God, it's like a Michael Crichton novel.
It's the worst.
That's insane.
It's so awful.
I mean, how serendipitously terrible.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly how these things developed over millions of years. The insect, the fungus, and the trees over in Eurasia,
yeah,
they developed this over millions of years, where the fungus is like, I got a great way to get myself from point A to point B.
Shit.
The beetle's like, whatever, I don't kill the tree, so I'm just going to keep going from tree to tree, and we're just going to be fine. And like, my population is going to be stable. The tree population is going to be stable.
Yeah.
And the trees at some point have figured out how to basically make resistance to it or tolerate it, basically. So either they don't get the disease or they just are fine having the disease and they can stop it and kind of compartmentalize it off without it taking over and killing the whole tree.
The European trees.
Yes, okay. Correct. Yeah.
But the North American trees
exactly
did not have those antibodies.
Green as summer grass, those things.
No.
Yeah, so what they do is they essentially would, this fungus would start growing up and down the vascular system in the cambium in all these little pipes. So what the trees do, they have these things. Remember when we talked about oak trees, about tyloses?
Tyloses. Oh, wow, that sounds familiar.
Well, I'll give you an update.
Okay.
They're basically these big cells that kind of balloon in the vascular system of old wood. So year one wood is actively doing stuff. Year two and beyond is basically starting to shut down.
Okay.
That's the sapwood. So the early or the latest sapwood closest to the outside of the tree, that's still alive and it's still moving up and down.
If not a little slower.
Yeah, exactly. So it only does water for the most part and stores some nutrients and some starches and things like that. And then as you go deeper and deeper, it kind of gets shot down more and more. And the tree sends in these little cells called tyloses, and they basically are balloons that grow up into those cells and stop them from moving and stop water from going up and down. You stop water from going up and down, you stop everything else from going up and down as well. It's kind of like they're just saying, okay, we're turning you off. We're now going to make you a part of the tree's structure.
And then they retire into the heartwood community.
Exactly. Ugh, and what a lovely community. You got golf courses there. You got a whole bunch of bridge games, shuffleboard.
Don't forget about Friday barbecues.
Oh, no, of course not. No, they do that every single Friday. In fact, every day is Friday.
And all the, you know, the sexual tension.
Oh, yeah. Jim.
Welcome to Heartwood.
Heartwood Meadows. So anyway, in order for the elm trees to survive this, they're going to put in these tyloses. They work their way into the cells and they say, oh, something's going wrong. I'm just going to block this cell off.
Okay.
Blows up this tylose. But if you do that too soon, you end up killing off everything because you're kind of like stopping the water flow going out to those extremes.
Yeah, it sounds kind of dangerous.
Yeah. Imagine the way I've always imagined it and described it to people is the disease basically causes the tree's veins to get a ridiculous amount of cholesterol.
Right.
That cholesterol then basically suffocates the branches at the far end.
God.
Yeah, it's the worst possible thing. And it also grows mycelium down through these tubes, and you can get these long dark streaks in the twigs if you were to try to just peel off the bark to like confirm, does this tree have this disease? But it'll send its mycelium down into the roots and then down into the roots of a grafted tree growing right next to it.
No.
Let's say it's planted 30 feet on center in some beautiful neighborhood like a Laurelhurst.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, you have these little bark beetles flying from tree to tree to tree to tree, infecting each one. You have the infections going through the roots of the tree, and then you get that to happen. Let's say the beetle goes in there and overwinters. Comes out the next spring, starts chewing away, the leaves will come out and then they will turn brown and they will wilt. And a lot of times around here you can tell because it's a certain beetle that only gets in the really tiny twigs. So you see just flagging is what it's called. You're like, that tree's flagging right over there. I can tell it's an elm because it has this gorgeous vase shape. That tree, I think, has Dutch elm disease.
Wow.
If you just keep watching it, the next year, a whole entire section of the tree will have died. Then you can see sprouts start popping out from the base of the tree. And so that's why I said earlier, you can also tell an elm tree because they just have sprouts all the way up and down the limbs, or the limbs, the twigs, the whole stems everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's because the tree's stressed, probably because it has this disease. It might be tolerant or resistant to it, where it can keep on living, but it's stressed. So it's sending out all these stress things. It's saying, more energy, send out more shoots. We need to capture every bit of light we can.
That's so sad.
It totally is. But this happens within maybe 2 years. If it's a tree that has no resistance to it, in 2 years, the tree will be dead. Easy.
So these sprouts, wow, oh my God. Yeah. These sprouts are like, what did we just talk about? What tree did we just talk about? Oh, the quaking aspen.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a bit like that where they're sending sprouts out from the roots?
Yeah, not so much the roots. This is more from just the stem itself.
Okay.
You just have a gigantic column of wood, and then poof, you just get new little twigs that just pop out from every inch of it.
So that when I see an elm, I'm positive in my mind that I've seen elms in Laurelhurst with sprouts in the middle of the trunk.
Yeah.
That's a stressed out tree?
It's a stressed out tree for sure.
But it doesn't get stressed out just from Dutch elm.
No, it could be almost anything. It's usually the worst, and you can see it. So around here in Portland, we have it, but it took a lot longer. So for your timeline, it started happening within 10 years. We're like, oh my God, so many of our gigantic trees are dying.
Wow.
And they were like, okay, quick, let's cut all these trees down and like cut the disease out. And like get rid of it before it starts to go away. But we didn't understand how it works. We just cut one tree down, it would be grafted by the roots to another tree, and you just have this domino effect going down the road.
Also, the damage has been done, right? The beetles are already onto the next tree, so it's killing the tree or chopping the tree down isn't going to do anything.
Well,
right?
It sometimes does if you can catch it quick.
Oh, then, while the beetles are still in there?
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Then you can minimize it. There's certainly going to be some that get out. It's just the way it's going to go.
Sure.
But here in the city of Portland, we actually have a rule, or like a if you see a tree that has that and someone calls it in or it gets noticed, then we actually go out and you have to cut it down within like 30 days. And then you have to either bury the wood or destroy it by fire. That's AC. How you gotta do it.
It's like a zombie infection.
It totally is.
Holy shit.
Get the flamethrower.
Yeah, you gotta shoot it in the brain with a shotgun and burn the corpse.
That's exactly it.
That is fucking awesome and brutal. Yeah. Wow.
That's how it is. That's what we have to do with these trees.
That's fascinating.
Yep.
That's my favorite thing I've heard on this podcast in a while.
Yeah, this is the true zombie tree. Well, so this is the thing, though. So as a street tree, it was an incredible tree. It was an iconic tree. It still is an iconic tree. You recognize it. We didn't even have to talk about where to go. You go to these neighborhoods, and there's a reason this tree was so incredible.
Yes.
To this day, people reading through Jill Jones' books, you can read through like people's lamentations about how they're like, it was the most beautiful thing.
Wow.
Like this whole forest, this whole row of trees, like... entire boulevards were like covered in this, and like you can look back and find these photos of like these old like Chicago's and Detroit's and all these cities with these like massive trees in every neighborhood, and then all of a sudden they just cut them all down, never replanted anything.
Shit.
And then we get what we get today, which is neighborhoods that have so few trees because we tried it once and we're like, well, that sucked, and we just never were like, oh, you plant it back. No one ever did.
Here's my question, my philosophical question to wrap up this discussion of Dutch elm disease before we get into our review.
Yes.
Do you think that Dutch elm disease and the blight of the American elm is some sort of karmic lesson about colonialism?
Oh, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And do you know my perfect example for this?
How, what?
So that is the quintessential homogenization of, let's say, if not a culture, in air quotes, a what used to be diverse forest ecosystem.
Yeah.
So you...
A balanced environment.
Exactly, where there would be several different species of trees. So if, let's say, you only had 10% perfect elm trees, then this disease comes through, the most it's going to do to your forest is wipe out 10% of your trees.
Right.
And most likely, if you also spread those trees out over the entire city, so not only do you have a species heterogeneous landscape, you also have it in terms of spatialness. So you have it one over here, then you don't have any for a while, then you have another one over here.
Right.
Just like what goes on in the tropics, for example. And that helps, that is a specific thing that helps keep forests safe. It's called resilience, and that resilience comes through diversity.
Right.
So if you don't have a diversity, that is the top lesson, like capital L, that we learned from Dutch elm disease, or rather that we should have learned, because we made the mistake again. We're still making that mistake all the time.
Right.
And but that's the thing that we took away. So any professional who would be saying, what's the best practice? They would say, plant the most diverse forest you can, at least in terms of an urban forest, because the more diverse an urban forest is, the more it is resistant to disturbance and the more resilient it is. Resistance meaning it can hold it back. So if you only have 10% elm trees, you only lose 10%, so you still have a 90% full forest. That's resistance. But resilience is it growing back and bouncing back quicker.
I see.
So if you only lose 10%, then you only need to make up 10%. Whereas if you lose 50%, you have to then make up 50%.
Yeah.
And that can be a lot harder than just making up that last 10%.
Amazing.
Easy. That's such a good question, Alex. Diversity, diversity, diversity. There's a rule.
Oh, what?
This is the rule. It's the 5-10-20 rule, in that this is the what most cities are trying to aim for, and that is no more than 5% of a given species across your entire city.
Wow.
No more than 10% of the genus of a given species.
And no more than 20% of a given family?
That's it, Alex.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and it's a rule that some folks came up with, and there's a couple variations. Some would say 5-10-20, some would say 10-15-20, some would say 10-20-30. Like, it kind of changes, which is totally fair. It doesn't have to be the same for everywhere. Diversity.
What is Portland's rule? Is it 5-10-15?
I think that's what we're going for, if not the 10-20-30. Because once you get to 30, the family, that's a pretty good size thing. Like, yeah. You can have a pretty diverse cadre in the families, but you have other diseases, like Dutch elm disease is specific to elm trees.
Right.
And elm things. So like the Zelkova, closely related, it's resistant though. But then if you go to the Emerald ash borer, which we'll talk about later this season.
Wow.
Because, spoiler alert, we replaced all of our elm trees with ash trees. And we learned another lesson.
Yes, this episode is the first in a trilogy.
Exactly. So you learned that, you plant ash trees, but this emerald ash borer affects all ash trees. So there's your genus level.
Right.
And then there's another disease that's called, or another insect, Asian longhorn beetle. And that gets like broadleaf trees.
Wow.
It's just, you know, you can't win every battle, of course. And, you know, you're always going to have to deal with something new. But generally, I think Portland's going for the 10-20-30. So once you get to the family level, you're pretty good.
Yeah.
Because that has a lot of different things in it. They can have a lot of different variations and resistance. And that kind of thing.
Fascinating,
there
Casey.
There you have it.
And with that, let us bore our fungled backs into the Cambium Arvar review of the American elm.
It tastes so good.
No, that analogy wasn't forced. What are you saying?
Honestly, yeah, is that our producer over there? I'm going to fire our producers.
Oh, I was talking to the discerning listener.
Oh, I see. I saw you looked off to one side in the room, and so I was looking to see. Yeah, I guess I can feel it. It's like you feel the audience not clap.
Yeah, like, I got a little hot in the cheeks. Casey, here's how it works. You and I are going to say our final thoughts on the American elm, and then give it a rating of 0 to 10 golden cones of honor. As our resident expert, we will begin with you.
All right. I think that this tree, I think we took a good thing and we squeezed it. We blew that bubble up. This is like a bubble, I think, like in the stock market sense.
Sure.
We took a good thing and we just inflated it until it popped. Mm-hmm. And now they can barely survive sometimes. It's really a tragedy. However, there is good news because we are developing resistant trees. Where I used to live in Portland, I think it's probably one of my favorite trees in the entire city, is one of the most beautiful elm trees I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Literally, it's like 100 feet in, like across in the canopy. The bark follows that same intense pattern from the very base of the tree up to the highest limbs because they are that big and that old.
Jeez.
And this thing is just massive. It, if it's not resistant, it has just gotten lucky for decades and decades. It's one of the biggest, most beautiful trees in this entire city.
Wow.
I love the elm tree. I think it's perfect. It's got an Achilles heel, so I'm going to give it an Achilles 8.0
golden cones of honor for the American elm from dendrologist Casey Clapp.
I think it's just a great tree. However, 7.8 because we need to stop planting it.
Oh my gosh.
Diversity.
Yeah.
Diversity.
Oh,
diversity.
I see.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm gonna take it down. Because I think if I go to 8, all the nursery folks are going to be like, well, let's just go to the completely arbitrary. Let's just hear all their 8s and just plant those because everyone loves that. There you go. All right. What about you, my friend?
All right. So the American elm, is one of my favorite looking trees that I've seen with my real life eyes. When I come across a street canopied in American elms, I'm like, oh man, God, it's good to be alive.
It's just got it. Like, you walk underneath it and you're like, this is nice.
Yeah, it's just a gorgeous aesthetic.
It's got it.
The American elm is the Robert De Niro of trees, Casey.
Yes, it is.
I know you love these analogies. I'll tell you this. It's Robert De Niro, not only because it's beautiful in age, because it used to be a king of its industry.
Yes.
Robert De Niro, classically known as, quote, one of the best actors of all time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Who are you quoting?
Me. Vulture. Vulture.com.
Right. Good, fair.
And then, you know, it shows up in War with Grandpa.
Yeah, Meet the Fockers.
And Meet the Fockers.
Oh, he was pretty good in Meet the Fockers.
I like that movie.
You know what? That was a good planting of Robert De Niro's.
I got one question, Casey.
All right.
Could you milk me?
You didn't even give your review.
I think it's like an extremely distinguished tree, but then you can't help but think, oh, right. It's at the end of its career.
Yeah, all right.
Its legacy is a little tarnished with War on Grandpa. What is it? War with Grandpa or something?
I don't know. I've never even heard of this movie.
But also, you know, Goodfellas and Taxi Driver and The Godfather.
All right, that's true. That's a hard one.
Boy, yeah, I'm so torn.
That's a great analogy, though. Like, I think that I can really run with that.
My golden cones.
Yes.
I'm going 7.6.
7.6. I think that's pretty good.
So I was like, I want to go between 7 and 8.
Yeah.
But right in the middle is a little low, so I'm going on the upper side of between 7 and 8.
I think it's really good. So if you were rounding, it would go to 8.
Yeah.
All right. That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think that's actually very good. I think it's a good one. I think that works. And especially because now my brain is thinking about Robert De Niro.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, yeah, 7.6. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
That makes sense.
In my heart, though, like if I really, for myself, not canonically in the podcast, this thing gets a 10 out of 10.
Oh,
no
yeah.
Problem.
Exactly. Like 1950, 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Casey, it's time for our segment.
What do we have today?
Today, I'm just so dang excited to talk about this thing. We're not quite playing a game, but we are having a discussion.
All right.
We're doing a fun little exercise, Casey.
All right.
Catherine Robert, a fungal associate, sent us an email saying, it'd be sick if you guys did a druid horoscope.
The druid horoscope?
Yes.
What is that?
So are you familiar with astrology?
I've heard about
it. The science of astrology, Mr. Scientist.
Yes.
Yes. The druids did not have constellations as their astrology signs. Casey, they had trees.
Oh my God. I just clicked on this and I was reading through it. And
yeah.
I saw this symbol up in the top right. We gotta post this. This is great.
Oh yeah, Casey. So wow. here's how it's gonna happen. There's a druid sign calculator at astrologyk.com/horoscope/druid.
Oh my
We'll post this
God.
On the website. Casey, well, let's start with you and read your sign. What day and month
what?
Were you born?
I get one? Okay, I was born the 21st of September.
The 21st of September, Casey.
Yes, which I want you to know is the solstice. No, it's not the solstice. It's the autumnal equinox.
Casey, your mind is going to be blown.
What am I?
You are a lime tree.
I'm a lime tree.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. All right. For those of you who may not be familiar, though, that actually is the linden or the tilia, not the little citrus fruit that's green that you put in your tequilas and things.
Oh, bummer. Okay. Yeah. Well, here's what it says. Traits of people born under the lime sign. Sociability. Check.
Oh,
observation.
Okay.
You know it. Realism. I don't know. You're a bit of a dreamer.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I guess, you know, sometimes.
Talent for organization.
Wow.
We'll skip that one. Compatible with the poplar, the rowan, and the fig. I love you, Casey.
Yeah, I love you. The rowan, the fig, and the what? The poplar?
The poplar. You guys all get along.
Yes.
So let me read this thing. Lime people are selfless. They constantly care about others and their difficulties and affairs. I wouldn't say that's untrue of you.
Yeah.
You definitely look out for yourself, but you're certainly a fantastic friend.
I try to be.
They are great to look after someone and fantastic parents, Casey.
Ooh.
As people of this tree are so sensitive and rather give than take, they're not so much predestined for social, but more creative jobs.
Oh, look at me.
Like podcasting.
Like podcasting. Very creative.
Yes, the ancient druids were some of the first podcasters.
They really were, and they did a fantastic job. Like, honestly, I can't. There's so many.
It is advisable to make clear to them that at an early age already, they have to be economical with their energy.
Ah, don't spend it all in one place.
That's right.
I see what this is.
So people of this sign seem to be a little quiet.
Mm.
even a little bit weak-willed, silent, and timid. Well, I take it all back.
Yeah, that didn't quite get there.
Literally the opposite of your personality.
Hey, you know what? It doesn't work for everyone. You know, it's a spectrum.
The strength of the lime is their sensitive and delicate character.
Oh, perfect.
With their open way, they are good at responding to people, and they always raise a bit of hope in others.
Well, shoot. I'm proud to be a lime.
It's absolutely true.
Yes! I feel good about this. This is amazing. Alex, what are you?
I was going to read this lime man. There's lime man and lime woman, the first sentence of the lime man is kind of sexist. So we're going to not read that.
We'll just skip over it.
I was born on the 20th of January.
Okay.
What you type it in. What am I, Casey?
Hold on. This is so exciting. You're an elm tree.
I'm an elm tree.
Oh my God. This is so good. Your traits, observation, mm-hmm. talent of organization. Therefore, we worked well together because we skipped that part for me.
That's right.
And realism. You bring it straight down to the truth.
Yeah. I don't know about the realism part.
Yeah. It's it says that you're compatible with cypress, beech, cedar, maple, and ash.
No lime.
Yeah. No lime. But it doesn't say that we're uncompatible.
Right.
So that's important.
That is important.
Elmborn, look at the world and see the things where other people turn a blind eye to. Look at that. Yeah, I think that's fair. People who need who other people turn an eye to, people who need help. So you're basically you don't turn an eye to those people who do need help. Regardless of themselves, they always want to help. In the worst case, this can even lead to self-abandonment. don't do that.
Anyway,
elms should therefore forego easy on their energy and should make sure not to lose touch with themselves. Mm. I think that's fair. You always got to be, you know, with you. I think you do that very well.
I'm a bit of a caretaker type, and I can get a bit lost in that.
I can see that. Ooh, oh, here we go. The strong side of the elm is its inborn optimism and joie de vivre.
Oh, joie de vivre.
Joie de vivre is what? That? I think that's French for joy of life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, that's a think, not a no, so let's just not Google it.
See, this third paragraph where this is the third paragraph where yours started to not sound like you.
Yeah.
This one starts to not sound like me. They don't revel in memories, and they don't wait for the future, but love and live now. 100% untrue.
That's so strange. Well, okay, so it does make sense, though. I think it's a time. You know, maybe the third paragraph ends up becoming the later year.
Yeah.
July 15th through July 25th.
That's right.
The love and family section just says, loved elm people are just fantastic.
Wow.
They even have the just in there.
That is great. Casey, we're going to do one more.
Okay.
That is of legendary actor Robert De Niro.
Yeah. What do we got, Robert?
Robert was born on August 17th.
Here we go. What do we got? He's a cedar.
Wow.
Oh, he's not even an elm. That makes sense. Impulsiveness, optimism, intelligence, ability to deduce, I assume is what they're trying to say. Compatible with elm, maple, jasmine, oak.
Uncompatible with?
Lime.
Wow.
And the willow, and the hornbeam, and the fig.
Cedar people are real personalities who pursue really big aims.
There you go.
Sometimes rather extreme, like being one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
It's either one or the other for them. They are glaring and fantastic personalities who are in full bloom in a warm climate.
Like Hollywood.
Yes. LA is quite warm.
This is so funny. Yeah. Robert, reach out to us. We got to tell you your druid sign.
Yeah, I like Robert. Hey, do you want to see my Robert De Niro face?
Yeah, I would like it. You look just like him. Oh, my God.
It's also my Mark Ruffalo face.
Yeah, well, they're both beautiful people, so this all works out well.
Casey, it's time for a completely arbitrary Q&A.
This is so exciting.
This week's question is from Wade Parker. Hi, Wade.
Hello, Wade.
Wade says, I have a space tree question.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was wondering what trees you could use in space. I'm writing a sci-fi book. I am personally a big fan of science fiction,
yep,
Casey.
Yep.
about people in space colonies and wanted to see what you both thought would work. I'm thinking that a space tree would want to be aesthetically interesting while also providing some form of nutrition and taking up little room aboard a spacecraft. Very interesting. Or in a dome colony. Are there any trees up to the task, Casey?
Okay, so the first thing that comes to mind is Biodome. Do you remember that movie with Pauly Shore?
Do I ever.
Those are the trees. Plant whatever they planted there. End of conversation. All right, okay, so here's my thing. I think that I can't give you any good species because it depends on the climate, right? So if there's a lot of sun and it can be warm temperatures, you'd probably want to plant some tropical trees or some trees that grow in like warmer climates, I guess.
Sure.
Not to mention if you can get a biodome, you can kind of, you know, keep the temperature a certain temperature, then you can predict exactly what you want to plant, how you want to plant, and all these kinds of things.
I've got it.
What do you got?
A ficus.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That grows figs. You can eat them.
Exactly. You plant fruit trees. There is a movie called Sunshine, which I thought was really great. If you haven't watched it, they basically have to go restart the sun. It's a super cool thriller.
Interesting.
No, honestly, great movie.
I got to reboot it.
Highly recommend it. But what they did is they had like on their spaceship, they had like this whole nursery section where they were growing potatoes and fruit and all sorts of stuff.
Sure.
Right? And so that's the kind of thing that I think you'd want to do. Plant mostly tropical trees because they just keep producing more often than the trees. And if it's a tree that's growing in a temperate region, it wants to go dormant, just like it wants to sleep and then come back. So small trees, avocado tree, because that's going to give you all sorts of nutrients and things like that.
Yeah, sure is.
I did that. You don't want to get scurvy out there, so I'd probably go with the lemon tree also.
Oh, good idea.
And then a couple things that grow nuts probably, if you can get some almonds and things like that. And then I would honestly, like, if you can grow it so perfectly, you can grow some vines on it. Like, keep the vines only on the bark and keep the rest of it a little bit higher. Make it so that you're taking up every ounce of light in every possible way.
There you go.
Most tropical things do that. You can plant the passion flower if you want and eat the passion fruit. So those are the kinds of things that I would think. It would be mostly tropical and be like you're walking into a conservatorium in a really cool botanical garden down in California or something like that.
Those are great ideas, Casey.
That's what I would do. I think that would be the most effective, and it would look really good. And plant potatoes, just like the Martian. You got to make sure you eat potatoes.
That's a good idea. Wade, thank you so much for your extremely interesting question. And hey, good luck with your book.
Yeah, and good luck. I hope you can like make that happen. Do you think Wade went to space with Jeff Bezos?
I think probably Wade went to space with Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, maybe Wade was the person who had the time conflict. Read that. Someone was like, oh, sorry, I got a meeting, Jeff. I can't make it.
Oh my God.
It's like, what? You paid like $28 million for that.
Oh, yeah. Here it says at the end of Wade's email, P.S. I went to space with Jeff Bezos.
Ah, Wade, sick.
Wow. That's cool, Wade.
Yeah. Way to spend your money in some place that's better for everybody. Thank you, Wade.
If you have a question about trees for Casey, email us at arbitrarypod@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram at arbitrarypod. That's ArbitraryPod. Or join the Patreon to support the podcast. Like our small army of supporters who mean so much to us. You can join the Arboretum for $5 a month, get 2 bonus episodes a month, or you can join the Cone of the Month Club for $10 a month, and you get cool stickers every month of cones by independent artists. How fun!
I love it. I love it. Just got samples of the next one.
We sure did.
Very exciting.
They are beautiful.
They really are. They glisten.
This is the Monkey Puzzle by Shauna Snyder.
Eee!
That has been this episode of Completely Arbitrary.
Wow. You know what? I feel like a lion. You look like an elk.
Thank you so much. Mm. I mean, that means I look like Robert De Niro.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
he's a cedar,
yeah.
But in my canon, he's an elm.
You know what? In all of our hearts, he's an elm.
This is the only time me and the Druids disagree.
Never again. Never before.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barfold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.